Mr. Gray is a graduate of Harvard University and of the University of North Carolina Law School. He was a law clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren of the United States Supreme Court. He's practiced law and was a partner in the law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering in Washington, D.C. And I will refrain from saying anything else about Mr. Gray because we are fortunate to have Mr. Lehman Lee, a student and forum member, who worked on the White House staff with Mr. Gray and will tell you more about Mr. Gray himself and his role in the Bush administration.
Hi, I'm Lehman Lee. I'm pleased to introduce Boyden Gray, who is the counsel to President Bush, and he's also a member of the senior White House staff. And Boyden's just come up from Washington, where the President and the Congress are now locked in this battle to slay the budget deficit monster. And that reminds me of the story about the two campers who are climbing up a mountain, and when they reach the top, one of them pulls out a pair of binoculars and peers through it and sees this great big grizzly coming straight at them. And he calmly sits down, puts the binoculars back, pulls out a pair of sneakers, and starts lacing them up. And the other camper says, surely you don't expect to outrun a grizzly. And he says, oh, I don't have to outrun the grizzly. All I have to do is just outrun you. Well, I guess that didn't flow. Boyden, since practicing law, he, in 1981, became legal counsel to then Vice President Bush. When he was serving as counsel to Bush then, he was the counsel to the administration's task force on regulatory relief, in which he led the administration's effort to reduce excessive regulation and burdensome regulation. In his current job, his responsibilities range across a wide variety of areas. His legal responsibilities include advising the President on all legal policy issues, advising the President on judicial selection. In fact, he played a major role in advising the President on the selection of Justice Souter, and also advising the President on ethical issues. But his responsibilities go beyond just legal issues. Because he's worked for the President for so long, he's really become one of the President's closest advisors, and he's played a leading role on issues ranging from disability to regulation, to banking. And two areas that he's really focused on are environmental and energy policy. And as most people know now, the Congress is on the verge of passing the Clean Air Act, which is perhaps the most important piece of environmental legislation in the last 20 years. And Boyden Gray has played a very, very important role on this particular piece of legislation. He's argued for years that people need to focus more on encouraging greater use of alternative fuels, these fuels that burn more cleanly and reduce energy dependence. And it's interesting to see that, in fact, the bill that Congress is working on now includes a number of provisions that deal with this, and much of the credit really belongs to Boyden Gray for that emphasis. And on that note, I'd like to introduce Boyden Gray.
I have to adjust microphones. I had an ancestor. My height comes from an ancestor who was in the Congress before the Civil War, and he was 6'8", which was very tall for those days, still tall for these days. And there's a story about him that he got into a fight, a debate, and ultimately a duel with Douglas of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, who was very short, about 5'3 or 4, but not lacking a certain confidence. And Douglas challenged my great, whatever he was, to a duel and gave him choice of both weapon and place. And my ancestor said, okay, if that's what you want, broadswords in the middle of the Potomac. And he won by default. I appreciate the introduction and the invitation. It's nice to be described in advance as interesting, entertaining, and informative. But I'll try to do the best I can. I was asked to talk about the relationship between environmental policy and energy policy. And in one word, it's a very difficult relationship. in Washington virtually impossible to reconcile. The environment and energy, of course, are scientifically and physically related, but they are politically and bureaucratically impossible to reconcile. And we are accused in the Bush administration of not having an energy policy. We do, in fact, have an energy policy, and we are, in fact, about to implement an even greater extension of an energy policy. It's called the Clean Air Act, but unfortunately, because of turf problems, it cannot be described, and it will not be described as energy policy, because energy and the environment are separate agencies, have separate reporters, have separate committees. And the nation will never perceive itself, I believe, as having a coherent energy policy, perceive it, and may not, in fact, actually achieve a completely coherent energy policy until these turf problems can be resolved. My favorite story, one of my favorite Washington stories, is the story of Secretary Harrington, Secretary of Energy in the second Reagan term, when Lee Thomas was administrator of EPA. Now, remember, Harrington's a cabinet officer, and Thomas is not. There's a bill pending to elevate EPA to cabinet status, but it's been stalled, and it probably will not pass this year. Harrington was at a staff meeting going over his schedule for the day, and he asked what this meeting was on his schedule at 3 o'clock. Why was this group coming in to see him? And a voice spoke up that they were coming in to ask him to ask Lee Thomas to do A, B, C, E, F, and G. And Harrington, in great desperation and frustration, threw up his hands and said, "Why is it that everybody comes in to lobby Lee Thomas? How come no one ever comes in to lobby me, to lobby me?" And the little voice in the back of the room, who didn't last very long in the employ of Mr. Harrington, said, "Because Lee Thomas has all the power." And that is a central fact that I want you to bear in mind as I go through this. Now, the Clean Air Act is an example of how the environment really is synonymous with energy in terms of policy. At a very oversimplified level, pollution is the result of incomplete combustion. That which reduces combustion or makes it more efficient also reduces pollution, and vice versa. Examples from the Clean Air Act, which I will get to, include oxygenated fuels, which put more oxygen into the combustion and make it more complete, or natural gas, which is a more efficient fuel than, say, gasoline or crude oil, because in part it needs no further refining. Now, one of the questions that you might raise, well, what's the best way to assure efficiency? And it turns out that one of the most efficient ways to ensure efficiency is to go at it by controlling pollution. And we've learned, I think, that the most efficient way to do that is by using the market incentives. A tax is an example of market incentives, but as you all well know, we don't like taxes very much. Neither, in fact, does the public. So regulatory alternatives are used instead, but the key here is to devise regulatory controls that create rather than reduce incentives to use the market. It's much better to have the marketplace decide where pollution or reduction should come than to have that decided by the company with the most deep-pocketed tack. Now, that's the way decisions tend to get made now in Washington. It's a question who has the best pack, not who has the best idea. Our Clean Air Act, which the Congress is on the verge of adopting, and if they do it right, perhaps we will sign it. We still have to take a look at the cost to make sure that any further reductions in cost get achieved. So I can't say that the President's going to sign it now. The final work has not been done, but I believe it's looking good at the moment. Let me just go through the three main areas that are involved. One is acid rain. Now, control of acid rain is a major energy issue. I will leave to one side the environmental benefits. One assumes that everyone here is familiar with those. But to get there involves major, major energy policy issues. In 1977, the so-called 77 amendments made a rather bad mess of SO2 control. You got into fights between high sulfur and low sulfur interests. It became a tug of war between the Midwest and the Far West, and the result was a really stupid set of requirements that call for the use of $300 million scrubbers, which are highly energy inefficient, which all they do is transfer pollution from the air to these collecting pools for later poisoning of the groundwater you drink. And they're very, very expensive. They also tilt the deck in favor of low sulfur coal in ways that the market, the most efficient way of doing it, would not have done. Some low sulfur western coal, where scrubbers are required just as they are in the east, some low sulfur western coal is so low in sulfur that one has to add sulfur to the utility boiler to make the scrubber work properly. This, I hope you would agree, is not a very sensible way of doing business. Because of these kinds of regional disputes, Clean Air Act revision was stalled and got nowhere. It wasn't a surprise that the 77 Act was a disaster. There was a wonderful little diatribe written shortly afterwards by a graduate of this law school named Bruce Ackerman, who was a law clerk the year I clerked, one of the smartest people I've ever known. He wrote a little diatribe called Clean Coal, Dirty Air about how political interests, special interests, combine to totally distort the issues. But for the Department of Energy in the Carter years, this scrubber requirement was the central issue, only it got played out in the EPA, not in the Department of Energy. We are going to install instead, if the Congress finally does it, and it looks like it's going to come out this way, a whole new system that will permit utilities to decide how they want to reduce to a certain level, and it will involve emission trading credits. A utility can go below what it has to and sell the excess to its neighbor who may not want to do anything at all, but will instead buy the reductions from its neighbor rather than achieve them on its own. This will assure that the lowest cost reductions are achieved. It will also be the greatest engine for conservation, I think, that this country's ever seen, because it will be in the utility's interest to induce its own customers to conserve and thereby generate extra credits for sale on the open market. This, in fact, is already occurring. The big winner in terms of fuels is in all likelihood to be natural gas, which the Carter administration had the wisdom of totally banning from any utility boiler use whatsoever. Again, a perversion of the way things should be. So that you understand what the Carter administration policy was, they prohibited not only the use of clean coal in utility boilers, they even went further and prohibited the use of the cleanest fuel of all, namely natural gas. Don't tell me that makes sense, because it doesn't. Rather than get involved in the politics of the coal industry versus clean coal versus dirty coal versus natural gas versus crude oil versus this versus that, we have said, let the market duke it out, and let's try to get rid of the PACs. We're not having much luck getting rid of the PACs, but we have, I think, locked the market in on acid rain control. It's also true that the greenhouse effect will be the big winner. The Environmental Defense Fund estimates that because of the market efficiencies, the conservation efficiencies that will be induced by our trading system, that we'll get 240, 250 million tons CO2 reduction annually. Now, mobile sources, it's like utility acid rain control, in the sense that all the emphasis has been put on what comes out the smokestack or the tailpipe. No one ever thought about what went in the gas tank or in the front. And again, what the president's done is proposed that a level playing field, a market mechanism be induced, be introduced, so that we can try to achieve the reductions on the lowest cost per ton basis. This will mean, under the Clean Air Act, as it's now about to get finalized, a dramatic introduction of new fuels, cleaner fuels, the ultimate composition of which is still up to the marketplace. There'll be a lot more ethanol used, made from grain. There'll be more natural gas-based methanol. There will be a lot of compressed natural gas, all of this used in cars. Revolution has already started, even before the bill is passed. ARCO started marketing a clean, reformulated gasoline in Southern California about 4 or 5 months ago, and within 2 months had increased its market share from 30 to 38% of the California market. It's fastest jump in market share in any major market in anyone's memory. Now, we've been told by the oil industry that all this is going to bankrupt the oil industry. I'm exaggerating, but that it's going to cost an incredible amount and can't be done, and oh, moan, oh, groan. But we don't think that's true. ARCO just today or yesterday sent today's paper, announced that third quarter profit earnings, profit showing, which indicate that it is the only major to show a big profit increase in its marketing and refining operations. And they did this despite two things: a price freeze at the pump in the aftermath of the Kuwait invasion, and two, the prior introduction of this clean fuel, which everybody, all of its other competitors, contends will drive them out of business. So this has been a great success story already. Even if the act never is signed, it'll be an even greater success story if the act is signed, which I believe it will be, but I can't obviously commit now. The result of both acid rain and the mobile source titles of the bill will be ultimately, by the year 2000 or so, to reduce or to displace about a billion barrels, the equivalent of about a billion barrels of oil imports a day. That is very, very significant. It comes, in a sense, totally free, because the system is already paying for it in terms of protection of the environment. Now, on air toxics, which is the third area, again, the president has basically got the structure he wanted, which again is to try to look at regulation on a performance standard basis, that is, what is the greatest protection at the lowest cost. And we, I think, have finally begun to break into the rubric that the way you measure the harm that a factory does is by hypothesizing what I call the sleeping bag man, who lives inside the plant for 70 years, never goes on vacation, never takes a weekend off, and indeed, as far as I can tell, never goes to the bathroom. He is exposed to that leaking pipe for 70 straight years without interruption. This, of course, is not the real world. Many plants are located in sparsely populated areas where there's no human exposure whatsoever. About 90% of the benzene, which is one of the most potent human-made, man-made carcinogens, that 90% of it is released, that is released into the atmosphere, comes out of chemical plants, petrochemical plants, coke ovens, and steel plants. But 90% of the human exposure comes out of the automobile tailpipe. So it stands to reason that if you're really trying to go after human health, you would focus a lot more on the automobile tailpipe than you would on chasing down the manufacturing plants there might be in the country. Now, that's going to happen as a result of the Clean Act. The focus is going to be more on the automobile tailpipe as a greater source of public health benefit than was before understood. It so happens, of course, that the benzene, which is the most serious public health threat being addressed by the Clean Air Act, is also the most active component in the generation of smog. And so you're getting two birds with one stone. In fact, you're getting three, because aromatics, of which benzene is the principal one, and which characterize the high octane gasoline, which nobody really needs to buy unless they have a Jag or a BMW, is bad for your automobile engine. And GM expressly recommends that people not use high octane gasoline unless it's required by the owner's manual. The oil companies don't really tell you that the additives that they put in their high octane gasoline, which sounds so great, are put in there to clean up the stuff they just put in before in order to make it high octane to begin with. And the combination of all these things is to gum up the fuel injectors, and we're all better off without any of it. All this will begin to play out in the Clean Air Act if it comes out right. And as I say, the biggest winner will be natural gas. Now, does this natural gas, in the sense of it being used as a boiler fuel, being used in a car, being converted to methanol to be used as a liquid fuel, fuel cell technology, which is the long-term goal, I think, of most people in this arena, will probably be based on methanol or a natural gas, and even electric cars, in the end, of course, depend on electricity, which is generated in a boiler, which, in all likelihood, will be running on natural gas. Is this good energy policy? Yes. We don't know how much natural gas there is left in this country. It's barely been drilled for. What's been looked for is crude. Natural gas has always been a byproduct. We don't know how much there is in this country, in this hemisphere, or indeed in the world. What we do know is that, generally speaking, based on known reserves now, whereas two-thirds of the world's crude is located in the Persian Gulf, only one-third of the world's natural gas is located in the Persian Gulf. And that is a big, big swing, and a more rapid, accelerated conversion to all kinds and forms of natural gas will greatly reduce the leverage that Saddam Hussein will have in the future. Unfortunately, this takes time and can't really be done overnight. This is a matter of interest for those of you who might care. One of the most little-known but most important agencies in Washington is called FERC. It's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And one of the worst assignments as a law clerk in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, is to be given an assignment to do a FERC appeal, and thereby become, for that week, the FERC clerk. This is a terrible blow to any aspiring clerk, but it is very important what FERC does, and it is now sitting on pipelines. One of them just recently got freed up, the Iroquois pipeline, which will serve New England, this area. It is sitting on pipeline applications that represent 2.3 billion barrels of oil displacement. Again, this is natural gas. One of my favorite stories is the story of a fellow named Moncrief, my age, the son of the famous, I guess, Tex Moncrief, his name is, in Fort Worth, who's one of the great wildcatters. His son is also very successful. Told the story about how he had good news and bad news on an oil strike in the overthrust, a gas strike in the overthrust belt. And his friend said, well, what's the good news? And the good news is, he said it's 4,000 4 trillion cubic feet of gas after 16,000 feet of drilling. And his friend said, well, how good is that news? And Moncrief said, it's pretty good. Well, how good? Well, he said, at today's price is worth about $6 billion. And his friend said, well, what in the hell is the bad news? And Moncrief said, I haven't got a market for it. So one of the things that we hope to do with the Clean Air Act is create markets for this very available and very, very clean resource. Now, could we get all to this through energy policy directly? I don't think so, because of the way Washington works. There are two bureaucracies. There's Department of Energy and there's EPA. And as my example of Secretary Harrington illustrates, they don't like to talk to each other, and they avoid it at all costs. Part of this, in turn, is the result of committee fragmentation. In the Senate, there's the Energy Committee. There's the Environment and Public Works Committee, and then there's the Agriculture Committee. And they don't have any common members, and they never meet together, and they never talk to each other. And it is therefore very difficult to get a coherent strategy out of this complex. Now, why do we have all this committee fragmentation, which leads to fragmentation down at our end of Pennsylvania Avenue? Why do we have it? We didn't used to have a Department of Energy. That was a Carter creation. Now we have it, and do you think we can get rid of it? Not on your life, even though it doesn't do much except fight with EPA and run the Department of Defense's nuclear programs. If you really think about it, the Department of Energy doesn't have anything to do at all that relates to energy. It, as I say, runs the Defense Department's nuclear programs, and the other thing that it does is house FERC, but FERC is an independent agency over which it has no control whatsoever. So what does energy do? I mean, I don't really know, to tell you the honest truth. I can't tell you. Now, why do we have all this committee fragmentation? Well, it's primarily designed to maximize public exposure for congressmen and senators, I believe. The more committees there are, the more PAC funds you can raise. PAC money is now running on a ratio of incumbents to challengers, a ratio of 30 to 1. Very hard to lose a race, or very hard to see turnover in the House of Representatives with that kind of a ratio. The re-election rate in the House, as you know now, is about 99%. The turnover is less there than in the Soviet Central Committee. There are about 270 to 300 committees and subcommittees. One's always losing track of just how many there are. There's no joke in Washington that if you run into a congressman or a congresswoman whose name you can't remember or whom you've never met, and never knew, the safest thing to do to avoid embarrassment is simply address him or her as Mr. Chairman. And that will take care of any introduction. There are about 80 or 85 subcommittees and subcommittees with jurisdiction over foreign policy, about 50 or 60 over illicit drug problems, 40 or 50 over the EPA itself. Very hard to have a coherent strategy. And within the Department of Energy, there are different little fiefdoms. There's fossil fuels, there's renewable energy, there's this, there's that. What's missing, of course, is there's no Assistant Secretary of Energy for natural gas. Accordingly, natural gas has been totally ignored over the years. EPA, on the other hand, has been generally considered to be the captive of Senator Byrd's coal interests. That's been very difficult to change, but the EPA does not have jurisdiction over the Fuel Use Act and the Natural Gas Policy Act. Those are two acts that are under the jurisdiction of FERC, which in turn is under the control of the Congress, not of the executive branch. One of my favorite examples of the chaos is a former graduate of this institution and an employee of this institution. I don't want to identify him too clearly. A contemporary of mine, a little ahead of me at Harvard, who is a member of the Energy Committee, who called me up one day a year ago or a year and a half ago to complain about our alleged lack of international leadership on global warming. And I said, but we're having difficulty integrating the Department of Agriculture into our policy making. It's very important. We know a lot about sources, but we don't know yet as much about sinks. Sinks, by sinks, I mean the things that absorb the forests, the crops, trees, and of course, the oceans. It also turns out, of course, that the fastest growing greenhouse gas is methane, which is primarily attributable to rice farming and cattle farming. So agriculture is a very important player in all of this. Well, this senator said, trees, crops, forests, what are you looking at those for? And I said, but Senator, you just came back from the Brazilian rainforest where you looked at the burning of the rainforest and how that adversely impacts CO2 production. How can you say? He said, trees, crops, forests, they're irrelevant to global warming. And I said, how so? And he said, different committee. That is really true. Now, the one exception to all this is the real chairman. I mean, when you say Mr. Chairman, there's only one person you can be referring to in reality, and that's John Dingell. And in his committee, and he's ever seeking larger and larger jurisdiction, of course, but in his committee, he has both the energy jurisdiction and the environmental jurisdiction. And that is why, whenever there are conferences between the House and the Senate, he almost always wins. And why? Because he's representing the whole picture, whereas the Senate is only representing half or even or even less. Now, is there any hope? I don't know. Congress has to rationalize its structure. We have to do a little bit better at our end of Pennsylvania Avenue to make sure that that Lee Thomas and John Harrington and their successors talk to each other. It is very, very difficult. Turf, 90% of life in Washington is turf. And if those of you who ever end up in Washington will quickly learn that. Policy becomes a secondary player to who's on the top and who's on the bottom. So with that cheering note, that should not discourage you from your studies and from learning the case method and everything else and doing everything you can. When you get to Washington, it's bureaucratic skills, and I don't mean to be too pessimistic, but it is not easy. But with the Clean Air Act, we are making progress, thanks to an executive branch a decision 2 years ago to put up a bill. It's the first time the logjam has been broken in about 14 years on clean air, and it could only happen because a unitary executive had to make some cuts that the Congress is not capable of making given its current structure. And with that, I'll end, and I'll be glad to answer any questions if people have questions.
Hi. I spent the last 2 years working on energy policy, actually, and the one thing that I found most baffling was something that recently happened where President Bush vetoed higher CAFE standards. For those people who don't know what they are, it's these are standards that set minimum standards, just a floor on how inefficient the automobile industry can be. And he did this at a time, he did this only a couple of weeks ago at a time when he's sending hundreds of thousands of Americans to fight for American oil interests in the Middle East, and I was wondering how he was balancing out the fact that we want to lower our consumption of oil, and we're willing to send Americans to die for American oil. But on the other hand, he isn't willing to take such a small step within America to lower our consumption here.
I think the answer to that is that it goes back to regulatory principles. There will be, I believe, a gasoline tax. How much is still up in the air. We believe that is a far better way to induce conservation than command and control regulatory hammer. I should point out to you that you may dispute this. A lot of people might dispute it, but I believe it's true that 90% of the increased fuel efficiency of today's automobile fleet is a result of market forces, only about 10% from the CAFE law now in the books. The marginal cost of each barrel of oil displaced under the so-called Bryan bill, the one he didn't veto it. We supported a filibuster, which encloture couldn't be invoked, so the bill never came to the floor. The marginal cost is $90 a barrel, and we really ought to be able to do better than that with $90 a barrel. So that's really the reason for it. Had the cost come in at roughly market prices, I mean the cost of drilling new oil, for example, I think we'd have looked at it a lot more kindly. Even assuming the worst case scenario, which I think is totally disputed by ARCO and Tenneco and the people who are actually in the reformulated gasoline business, but even assuming the worst case scenario on prices for clean fuels under the Clean Air Act, the top cost per barrel displaced is $25 a barrel, a much better bargain in our view.
You talked a lot about natural gas being a clean source of fuel, and you went out of your way to criticize the Carter administration for
nothing personal,
for not putting enough weight on that fuel. However, the Carter administration funded renewable energy at a high level, all of which was cut in the early 1980s. And I'm wondering what place renewable energy, which is much more clean, actually, than natural gas, I'm talking about solar and wind energy, what kind of place is that going to have in the president's energy strategy?
Well, I think it has a place now and will have a place if the Clean Air Act is passed, because what's going to happen is that a premium is going to be placed on clean electricity generation. And with other deregulation occurring in the electrical generating and transmission system, it will be highly advantageous, if it makes sense at all, to produce geothermal or wind or solar and sell it into a utility. And the utility, if this makes any sense, will pocket what are, by definition, acid rain reductions, and sell them in the open market and make a lot of money out of it. I would also point out, of course, that the most important renewable fuel or renewable source is agriculture, which is why I made that anecdote about different committee. It's important that it's a different committee, and under the president's clean air proposals. And these do, in fact, the support for ethanol and related products does stem, does have its origin in the Carter administration. That's the biggest source of renewable energy the world has. And we are seeing $150 billion of subsidies cranked into surpluses for agriculture when by a few simple tweaks in the system of each country, you could convert this huge renewable energy into the production of usable fuels. Brazil does this now. I don't mean the filibuster. Brazil does this now, and I think you'll see more of it worldwide.
Are you in favor of federal support for that source for agriculture? I know that one of the reasons...
I just told you that we're wasting worldwide $150 billion of dollars now in subsidies, which are totally wasted.
How much money?
And force people to have to pay more and all kinds of taxes. You know, that's part of the. But we are getting big reforms now as a result of the current budget crisis. The Agriculture Committee is now on a path towards greatly reduced agricultural subsidies.
So you support funding for research into.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I believe both the Reagan and Bush administrations have, on basic research, not done badly at all.
As I believe, for every dollar that's being spent on renewable research, there's $8 being spent on fossil fuel research and a little bit higher than that on nuclear. Is that price structure going to change at all?
I don't know that your data are right. I have no reason to question it, but I don't know that it's right. And I don't know whether you're talking about public sector, private sector.
Federal money going into research on different sources of energy.
I can't comment because you've stumped me. You know more than I do about that.
Hi, if I'd like to follow up actually on the natural gas question, which some of the comments you made, you said that the supply of natural gas is unknown, and obviously we can't tell what all is under the ground. But I think from current knowledge. In fact, China has by far the largest amount of natural gas supplies in the world, almost half of the known supplies. And in fact, at current usage levels, I think United States natural gas will only last about 20 to 30 years, whereas coal will last at current usage rates upwards of 100 to 200 years. My question is, given the Department of Energy Clean Coal Technology programs, I know there's some exceptions in the acid rain provisions for those programs, but don't you think there's some very good strategic and environmental and energy reasons to encourage, in fact, both high and low sulfur cleaning programs to continue to utilize American coal rather than rely on this fairly small supply of natural gas?
Well, the answer is I don't agree with your assumption that it's a small supply, but should we encourage clean coal technologies? Absolutely, yes. The reason why I emphasize natural gas is because it's natural gas that is going to come out of, in my opinion, come out of the clean coal technologies. They will be the ones that will survive and be marketplace winners. They will be combined cycle operations that convert coal into a gas which will be burned in a utility boiler as natural gas. And so I think that's why it's important to emphasize natural gas, not to pick it out as a winner, because what I'm suggesting is letting the chips fall where they may, but I believe the bridge to coal will be through natural gas.
The ultimate
clean coal technology is methanol, really. But right now, it just happens to be more cheaply made from natural gas, given the price of natural gas. Now, as technology develops, and as these projects develop, these clean coal technology projects develop, they may produce technology that can convert coal to methanol as cheaply as it can now be converted from natural gas. And if that happens, then the sky's the limit. And that, in fact, is one of the goals, one of the hopes. But you can't force it. You cannot force it. And if it's not economical, you ought not to pour good money after bad.
But do you feel that the strictness of the allowance program will allow those programs to develop? Admittedly, it will take some sort of enclave from market conditions, because those programs may not develop under the strict allowance program as it is.
Oh, I think the strict allowance program is going to be what really provokes it. My guess is that very little of value will come out of the $5 billion subsidy that is going into the program. I believe what good will come out of it will be invented in someone's garage somewhere that no one ever thought of, and that's what will spring loose. I don't know, but I just would guess that it's going to be some Stephen Jobs in his garage cooking up the Apple computer that's gonna be the winning technology, but I don't know.
I wonder if you could explain the president's justification for proposing that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge be open for oil and gas drilling.
Well, I'm not really familiar enough with that decision. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know that he had actually decided to open it up.
It's been reported in the press that the president has favored that.
I don't know that that's accurate.
So you have no comment?
I have no comment.
I don't mean to switch the focus at all, but since you're here, I was wondering whether you played any role in the president's recent decision to veto this year's civil rights bill, and if so, what kind of role was that, and what kind of advice did you give to the president?
Well, I don't really generally describe what my advice is, but I have been involved. Yeah, I just can't tell you I'm not at liberty to tell you. And in fact, sometimes when you advise a president on any issue, you don't know what your impact is. At least, I don't know.
Do you have any personal opinion about the bill that was passed?
I do. And my opinion is unfortunately well known. I'm not happy about it, that it's well known, or that I had to have an opinion of opposition. But of course, it isn't. One of the frustrating things is the Civil Rights Act of this year. Well, the most sweeping Civil Rights Act in 25 years was signed about 3 months ago. Now, this may be the second most sweeping Civil Rights Act in 25 years, but we've already had one most sweeping Civil Rights Act in 25 years, and people ought not to lose sight of that one. That's a very, very important one, which would not have happened without the president's leadership. It really would not have happened, and it involves the largest minority group in the country, if not in the world, namely people with disabilities. So I don't think that...
Mr. Gray, I wanted to ask you a quick question about one part of the Clean Air Act. The part is concerns the air toxics provisions concerning the acceptable cancer standard of 1 in 10,000. Now, as you probably know, in other countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, there's the cancer standard is as high as 1 in 1 million. And I was wondering how it is that you could justify a standard, sort of a cancer acceptability standard that was 100 times higher than is acceptable in other countries. And what's your position? What do you think about that?
Well, I think the way the Clean Air Act is going to come out is we're moving away from these what we call bright line standards into more judgmental criteria. The The Brightline standard that you refer to is highly theoretical, in fact. Why is that? Because it goes back to what I call the mythical man who or woman who never leaves the plant gate for 70 years. And it has nothing to do, this Brightline standard, with real human exposure. That's the one weak link. Well, of course, that's the whole link. And it's based on, hypothetical calculations that result from these wacko rat studies, which now are being under severe attack in the scientific community. One of the leading scientists in this area, Bruce Ames, has just recently published, I think, in the New England Journal of Medicine, saying we've really got to take a look at this because you cannot overdose a rat. Give it such a dose that you'll make sure it dies in 2 months so that you don't have to run this test for a year. They jam these doses so high as to make sure that everyone dies in a very short period of time, and then they try to extrapolate from that what happens to people. And that's, I don't think that makes any sense. What people really ought to be looking at is where is the exposure. And as I said to you, 90%, as I said to everybody, 90% of the benzene may be produced by manufacturing plants, but 90% of the exposure comes out of your car, and but the policy doesn't reflect that. Now, benzene is benzene, and it will kill a rat, depending on any rat with the same dosage at the same rate. But the question is, what is the dosage? And you can only do that by also looking at what the human exposure is. And what we're trying to do is to get people to think about what is the exposure. The Public Health Service, our own Public Health Service, said the only real public health benefit that will come out of the Clean Air Act is the substitution of alternative fuels for gasoline because of the reduction that will occur in benzene that comes out of your tailpipe. Anyway, that's an argumentative answer, perhaps.
I think you answered you made an argument for my case, I think, better than I ever could, which is...
Good. Well, then we agree.
Which is very simply... That given the uncertainty that we have in health risk assessment, a number of countries have decided to sort of err on the conservative side to say that we're not going to put our people at risk because we just don't know very much about health risk assessment at this point in time. And it seems like
they may have higher standards. I mean, they may have higher standards, but I don't know that any Scandinavian country is doing anything about automobile benzene exhaust. And they haven't even taken out lead yet. I mean, so don't be critical of our country. I mean, the first reaction is always to flagellate yourself, but we've led the world in phase out of lead, and we're leading the world now in phase out of benzene, and we're doing all right. We're doing all right.
Well, I mean, that's good, but how about dioxin? How about dibenzofurans? How about polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons? How about,
We're trying to get rid of the aromatic hydrocarbons. When I say benzene, I mean, I'm talking about the whole family of aromatics. All I'm saying is we're starting to do something about it. Other countries may opine about how bad it is, but we're actually doing something. Mm-hmm.
At a 1 in 10,000 level as opposed to a 1 in 1.
No, they're not. They're not doing anything with the gasoline in the car.
But
where the big exposure is.
But there are other air toxics.
I mean, you're missing the forest for the trees.
What? There are other air toxics issues besides cars.
Oh, I agree. I'm just saying that the car is the source of the greatest exposure. And we're leading the world and telling people how to go about attacking that. So shouldn't be so pessimistic about the U.S., the good old U.S. of A. Brightline standards get you off the subject, I think. And they become a comfortable sort of resting place when in fact it misses the point.
To your knowledge, what concrete steps has the president taken with regards to international obligations for a greenhouse effect? In other words...
Well, we're going to host the first global warming climate change convention, and the president, I think, has already succeeded in getting the international community to understand that the best way to go about regulating is to use market-based approaches. So I think the president's record on this is pretty good. Environmentalists think it's terrible, of course, and that's their obligation, I guess. We're not doing, again, not doing so badly. I want to go back to the question about bright line standards so that people can understand the connections here. And it's not well understood. They're just not well known. You may have seen in the front page article, this was front page New York Times and Post, I don't know about Boston Globe, but the embargo is working on Hussein now, according to these stories. And he's having to ration gasoline, even though he's one of the world's major producers of crude oil. Now, why is this? Why is he having to ration gasoline? The answer is because he can't get enough lead, enough additives, to produce the high-octane gasoline that his consumers want to buy. And I guess that's just a little teeny piece of trying to understand how critically important the role of aromatics is, and how pervasive it is in our society. People just don't know how pervasive it is, and why they don't know how pervasive it is, I don't know. When we were talking about phasing out lead, we did phase out lead in 1982-83 in this country, and then the question is what would be substituted for it, and we began to worry back then that aromatics would be the principal substitute, and we were right. And now we have to take the aromatics out, and we want to make sure that when we take those out, something even worse than those don't come in as a substitute. But these are very, very tricky issues, and they don't get publicly debated. When discussion in the cabinet room with President Reagan, when he set up the first working group on alternative fuels back in 1984, I guess it was, he made the comment. He said, you know, when it was discovered, lead was considered the leading technological innovation of the 20th century. This is 1920, so it's early in the 20th century. And people's eyes are glazing over, and Reagan says, well, I guess I'm the only one here old enough to remember that. And of course he was. We tend to forget the role that some of these things have played in the development of our basic industrial base. It's time to get them debated again, but I don't know. One of the people here who's from the Ford Foundation, I can't remember, where are you, right? Has worked and in the past for the Ferruzzi Group in Italy, which is one of the leading agribusinesses in the world, one of the leading business concerns in Europe, and they've been very, very aggressive in trying to push agriculture products back into the mix. It used to be that, and I had this this description from a French, from the head of the French Sugar Beet Growers Union, who said, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, he was wearing a tweed jacket. He said, this jacket came off the farm. Today it comes out of the refinery. This color, this pigment color here, came off the farm. Today it comes out of the refinery. He pulled out his wallet, pointed to his shoes, talked about his wife's handbag. 30 years ago, it all came off the farm. Today it all comes out of the refinery. And what we got to do somehow as a society is let the farmer back in to the manufactured product game. Anyway, that's maybe too philosophical. Okay. Yeah, I gotta go back to Washington, back to the land of who shot who. Thank you all. Hope you enjoyed it.
Studying biology.